Welcome to Cider Chat. This week, it's part two of the ongoing series titled Building a Cidery. And we're going to be looking at how you can secure a trademark for your brand.
Going up, going up.
Hello, my name is Rhea Wincaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world.
Hip, hip, hooray!
If you are new to this podcast, well, you should know that I'm going to chit-chat a little bit here, give you some updates, a little bit of news from our sponsors, and then we'll be getting into the featured conversation. Because there's a lot that goes on in Ciderville. I mean, at least in my life, there does. It's been kind of a fun weekend for me. I just want to start there, I guess. I had a little fire outside. Because why not? It's January. It's also a time of the year that us folks in the apple orchards like to celebrate wassail. This is a traditional English carol that is sung out in the orchard. I guess it has evolved over the years, if not centuries. And it is a toast to the health to your neighbors and definitely to scare out the evil spirits out of the apple orchards. You gotta love. And on that note, to you, Ciderville, I say wassail. Speaking of England, I wanted to give you a little bit of an update for those in the know who remember the Shelton Brothers importers who have been bringing amazing ciders in from all different parts of the world. Well, they have closed their doors, and that's kind of shook things up for a lot of makers. And I had the opportunity to ask Tom Oliver how that was going to be affecting his imports into the U.S. So he wrote back and said that Sam at Ancho, and Ancho is in Washington, D.C., so we want to be sending them a lot of love this week because they are really kicking it out down there for the big inauguration happening this day that the podcast goes live on January 20th. And they have a collaboration cider called Hereford Gold. And there may also be a Perry in 2021 and another canned Oliver's Ancho cider. So we get to get a little bit of Tom either way. So that sounds good. Ancho will also be importing some other Oliver's cider and Perry and a little bit of Ross on Wye Perry and even some little Pomona cider. And that's all going to be available via Vino Shipper through Ancho. That's at least what he believes. And that container is due to leave January 2021, which is this month. So good news for all of us who just love Tom Oliver. And of course, you know, I love Ross on Wye Cider and Perry Company and those folks at Little Pomona, all based up in Herefordshire. Oh, man, what a time. You know, I just had that Totally Cider tour all set up for this last fall, and I just want to tell you, it was a kick-ass tour. Going to be seeing all those folks, and so this might be the best that we could do for now. So let's hope that it's smooth sailing between England to the U.S. down to Washington, D.C., seeing a little love down to Ancho. I'm on the website right now for the New York International Cider Competition because I wanted to see who the winners were last year and what the categories are. I mean, they have a gold, a silver, a bronze, and then individual winners. And I looked basically straight to the individual winners because that gives me a list of folks who were entering and the different locations where they are. And some of these places I've never heard before. So let's see. There's Black Apple from Arkansas. There is a Arizona cidery called Desert Cider House. I didn't know about these places. And that's one of the beauties of competition. Sometimes we think in terms of, oh, hanging the medal on my wall, that's going to be, you know, that's it. That's why I'm doing the competition. Or the fact that I'm going to get input from trade buyers, such as this competition. That's the kind of judges they have, retail buyers. But the other piece is you get your name out there for folks like me in the media, folks who write about it, folks who talk about it. They are looking at competitions to find out new info of who's on the market. We do a lot of research. It's not like we're just waiting for people to send us stuff. We're always doing research, at least I am, for the podcast, to then be able to talk to you, Ciderville. So that's a win-win. That's like a double win, don't you think? And if you want to get in on this, go to nyicidercompetition.com. Enter your cider, get feedback. You might get a medal on the wall, and you'll also get your name on the page, letting us know in the industry that you are out there. And that is a double win-win, kind of like a double gold. This event takes place February 21st, 2021, nyicidercompetition.com. I decided to open up another web page right now, and I am on ciderassociation.org, and I went to the speakers section because this is a website that you go to register for CiderCon, and it's going to be virtual this year. It's taking place February 3rd through the 5th, and I am on the speakers page, and I'm looking at all these people that I'd so miss because I won't be seeing them in person, but I get to see them online. So, you know, there's always some way to find the silver lining in this middle of a pandemic, and here we are. One session I see on the top is troubleshooting canning issues with cider, and that's probably a really good one for commercial makers to get into. This one is really neat. It's a session on consumer expectations of single varietal cider and apple varieties. Consumer expectations of single varietal cider and apple varieties. That sounds really interesting. I haven't had time to look at this stuff, so I'm kind of stoked. There's a lot here, and I will continue to remind you to sign up for this until we get to the actual event on February 3rd. But I can't do the work of signing up for you. You got to do that. So go to ciderassociation.org and get on it. You could sign up if you are a cider enthusiast. You know, it's really accessible. Do it. CiderAssociation.org. See you there. Up next, the Q&A with Fermentis. And we'll be hearing from Kevin Lane once again. And this is question number 6 on the list of questions I had for Fermentis. Last week, we were talking about rehydrating dry yeast and to do that with water or apple juice. And he did great coverage on that. This week, he's going to be talking about how you actually rehydrate dry yeast. So let's head to Kevin next.
Hello, my name is Kevin Lane, and I'm the technical sales support manager for the Americas for Fermentis. As I was just talking about with the rehydration and the easy to use, it's not necessary anymore. I'm not sure that it was at some point, and it probably was, but it no longer is necessary to perform a starter or propagation. There's no reason to have to revitalize the yeast or to build healthy cells. Really, for the Fermentis yeast, it's ready to be used immediately. And again, you can pitch it in your fermenter. You can rehydrate it outside your fermenter. I think, you know, the question of how do I make a starter for my yeast before pitching it into my cider, that's very complicated when you really look at it and when you really look at the science behind growing yeast. And I say that because it's not just that the yeast need a sugar source, either to grow or to produce alcohol. They actually need a lot of nutrition. Some strains are more robust and don't need as much nutrition, but all yeast are going to need nutrition to grow healthily. And that gets really complicated. Of course, there are yeast nutrients in the market that are available that are there to supplement nutrition for the yeast. They do a great job as long as you're using the right ones and in the right quantities. And that's where it really gets difficult because I'm not aware of any nutrient that's 100% sufficient for proper yeast growth. And that's because when you have proper yeast growth, you're trying to avoid the alcoholic fermentation, which means that your sugar source is going to be extremely low. And with that extremely low sugar quantity or amount in the media, below 0.5%, really balancing the nutrients is extremely complicated because you really don't want to overdo it and add too much of anything, and you really want to monitor all the nutrients so that the yeast has what it needs when it needs it, and you're not giving it too much of, for example, a mineral like zinc and not enough of a different mineral or compound that the yeast is needing at that point in time. So really it becomes very complex when you're trying to do a starter or to grow yeast or propagate yeast in the best way. And I think all of us, when we go to ferment anything, we're hoping or we're really wanting the healthiest yeast that we can have, so that the fermentation performs well, performs on time. We don't have off flavor development. We don't have struggling fermentations. We don't have problems in fermentation.
All right, Kevin, I get it. I'm overthinking it already. I'm a cider maker. I can't help myself. I don't have to worry about rehydrating that yeast or doing a starter. All I have to do is open that package of fermentous yeast and sprinkle it onto the liquid, and away it goes. And when it comes to yeast nutrients, I just throw in a bunch of raisins. That always works for me. Alrighty, it's now time for part two of the Building a Cidery series. Last week, in episode 255, you met attorney Kevin Regan, who is based in the Pacific Northwest, and he's talking about trademark. Part one was on what a trademark is, and in this week's episode, you're going to find out the steps to take to secure a trademark. So let's grab a glass and head to this chat with Kevin Regan.
So the big question everybody asks is like, well, how do you actually get these trademark rights? The answer to that is that, you know, when you start selling cider, you start acquiring what are called common law trademarks. And so just to give you an example, one of my clients, El Corazon Winery, they don't have a federally registered trademark for El Corazon. So you might see, you know, again, whether you're at Starbucks or in the grocery store, you might see this little TM. Now, having a TM, it doesn't give you any rights, but what it does is it communicates, you know, you might have like, you know, content on your website, but it tells people like, this is our trademark. We are using this as a trademark. So if you have a new idea for like a cider name, it's good to mark your trademark. It doesn't give you rights, but it helps kind of like grease the skid if you need to make arguments about, you know, we were using this thing as an actual trademark. In contrast, you know, we've been talking a lot about registration. In federal registration, it's really the preferred method. There's a whole state registration system, but, you know, hopefully, you know, for most producers, they hope to be in a few different states. They hope to have a, you know, a little range of distribution, you know, and so you see the little R in a circle. They call that the encircled R. That basically means this is a federally registered trademark, and you can't use that little symbol unless you're actually registered. So if you apply with, like, you know, picture your bottle and you have the little R on there, the trademark office, they'll kind of ding you. You know, they'll make you fix that. So the thing that throws people off, because you often hear, like, hey, I want to trademark this. And actually, like, trademark, it's not so much a verb, like you go and you get that trademarked. It's like you're selling something, you know, you have rights through your sales, but registering it, it's almost kind of like recording title for your house. It sort of expands out those rights. And so if you're selling in two states, like as a hypothetical, let's say you're selling in Washington and Oregon, you know, at that point you have what's called use in commerce. You can get a federal registration, and maybe you've never sold in Hawaii, but if somebody comes out with, like, you know, some kind of Hawaiian cider, you have rights against them. It's like you magically have been selling in all 50 states. And so that's why the federal registration system, like the goal of the federal law is to try to promote certainty. And, you know, by registering, it gives you a lot of rights. And to have common law rights, you need to actually lawfully sell your good. So, you know, if you don't have permits, let's just say you're just making cider and selling it without the TTB permits, you don't have lawful use, so there's some exposure there. You know, similarly, like let's say you're selling a cider that's like 9% alcohol. If you don't go get that cola, you know, the other side in trademark infringement litigation 5-10 years down the road, they could say, hey, we just did, you know, some searching and it looks like you didn't have a cola. So that's just an example of, you know, you need lawful use to have common law rights. Now, in contrast, in the federal system, you can actually reserve a trademark in advance of using it. It's called an intent to use application. And so when you file one of those, in some ways, you know, you're trying to reserve it in advance. You're testing the waters, you know, before, you know, you have your big brand launch. Ideally, you do a few intent to use applications, you test the waters, And for some reason, if you start running into problems at the USPTO, you still have time to pivot. So that's what I really recommend. And then, I mean, to give you an example, so let's just say hypothetically, I applied for an intent to use trademark tomorrow, right? And so, you know, again, I apply tomorrow, you know, February 1st. And then let's just say, you know, sometime in March or April, another cidery, you know, they start actually selling a cider in the marketplace. You know, they're the first to the market, but I was the first to file. You know, I would have rights, conditional rights, as of the date I filed. So, you know, my sort of one of my takeaways with intent to use applications is apply early and often. You know, it's like if you can kind of come up with a stable of some potential mark ideas, you can kind of have some on deck as you need to roll out a new product. And again, you can have that certainty in advance. Okay. So again, you know, there's this concept of first in time, first in right. But that example I just gave illustrates that sometimes it's the first one to apply trademark office that, you know, gets the rights. Again, when you see a TM, it typically means it's common law trademark rights. And, you know, the R in a circle means federally registered. So as I've been, you know, describing, the trademark office and courts, they increasingly treat all alcoholic beverages as the same. So in terms of a dispute that happened, I wasn't personally involved in it. You had, you know, Bad Granny Cider, and, you know, then basically they got into it with Sazerac. And Sazerac had this Granny's, it's like a gingerbread cream liqueur. So even though, you know, they look different, this one's kind of creamy and sweet, this one's clear, you know, even though there's all these differences, you know, the trademark office still treated it the same. So one of those disputes at the trademark office, what they call a cancellation proceeding or an opposition proceeding, most of those things settle at some point along the road. But if somebody goes all the way to the mat at the trademark office, you're looking at something between $50,000 and $400,000. And so again, it's rare that people go all the way to the end. But what happens is at the end, you know, you get a decision about who's got the rights to that trademark. And if you lose, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to stop selling in the marketplace, but the winner's going to march that decision over to federal court and try to get that injunction. And that, again, is what you really want to avoid. So, you know, we've been talking a lot about some of the expensive options, right? But so, you know, here's an example of a way that these kind of disputes can get resolved. So you have a brewery that, you know, was selling a beer called Kingpin. And then you have a Washington winery that was selling a wine called Kingpin. And what happened there, and this is stuff that's public record, is, you know, the winery was using it first, but they didn't register their trademark. And, you know, so the brewery comes along and registers their trademark. And several years go by, and then, you know, the winery learns about the situation, and they reach out to the brewery. And even though that brewery has that registration, you know, they're as a practical matter, not too worried about, you know, the wine. It's a brewing company that, like, it's not like Constellation Brands. It's, you know, they're focused on beer. And so they're like, you know, I think we can live together. And because that winery had the leverage of first use, they were able to, you know, work out a deal, what's called a consent agreement, where both sides kind of agree, like, hey, we're Kingpin for beer. And then the other guys are like, we're Kingpin for wine. And so the two can coexist in the marketplace. And so that's often what you see in the alcoholic beverage space. And that's actually one of the reasons that I recommend, you know, if you're searching around for trademark attorneys, that you look for somebody that has experience in the alcohol beverage space. Because, you know, even though there's all these stories in the news about cease and desist letters and all that, it tends to be that there's a little bit of a more cooperative approach. Even some of the big wineries, you know, like they might be able to live with a beer. You know, it just kind of depends. But again, it's advantageous to have that first use. But if the winery would have registered as trademark, it might have been an even more powerful position. And if it was important enough to the brewery, they could have said, okay, brewery, we're going to let you use it for beer, but we're going to charge you some money. And then that's sort of a business decision. How important is that name to the brewery? And, you know, I mean, the results kind of vary with this trademark stuff. But, you know, I've had situations where, you know, a small client will get, you know, a cease and desist letter from a much bigger company, but the small, you know, cidery, they did things right and they registered their trademark. And so, like, literally sometimes these big companies will acquire those trademarks for figures and for six figures. And again, that's not common, but it just, again, it's this idea by registering a trademark, establishing your rights, you have an asset. It's an intellectual property asset. So, you know, we're talking about all these problems, right? So now I kind of want to shift focus to some of these practical strategies that you can start taking, you know, right now and as you go forward. You know, one of the principles of law is that you need something that's called a distinctive trademark. And, you know, on the one hand, that means something that stands out to the consumer, but it also has some legal meaning where a distinctive mark, it's something that's not generic. And so a generic mark is something that just tells what it is. So if you had, like, Clear Cider as your brand, you know, there is a good chance if your cider was fairly clear, they would say, hey, that's just generic. Or if you had, like, Bubbly Cider as your mark, that would be a hard trademark to register. Something you often see is people will name their companies based on geography, you know, where they're from, where they're based. You know, they often take that as part of their story. Like, let's just say I want to be Oakland Cider Company. Well, if I'm in Oakland, California, and I apply to register Oakland Cider Company, I'm going to get a refusal from the trademark office. And that doesn't mean that there's not some things you can do to kind of get that back on track. There's something called acquiring distinctiveness, where if you've been selling for 5 years, you can say, hey, we've been Oakland Cider Company for 5 years. When people hear Oakland Cider Company, they know it's us. And at that point, you can get a registration, but there's some limitations to that registration. And so, you know, one of the sort of things is that, you know, you can get a registration for a geographical place, but it's going to be a little more difficult. And it might be a little harder to defend, because then you have, like, Oakland Brewing Company come along, and then you have these sort of new headaches to worry about. So I kind of alluded to what's called a descriptive trademark would be just describing some aspect of your product. You know, so if it's, you know, you've got, like, you know, if you wanted to call your cider Brett, but, you know, it's sort of features Brett, it's kind of got that nice, you know, horse blanket flavor, that might be what's called a descriptive trademark. And again, there's some clay to work with, but, like, I often kind of counsel my clients, like, let's look at the path of least resistance. Let's try to find a distinctive mark. Because at the end of the day, it is the court that's going to decide how strong a trademark is when you go to litigate a trademark. And it's also the trademark office that's going to decide whether you're distinctive enough to register. One of my cider clients, he came up with a mark, Atrova, which he ended up not using in the end. But basically, it was sort of like a matchup of parts of the names of his kids, right? So he took, like, some of the letters from the kids' names and kind of smooshed them together. And on the one hand, you know, a mark like that, it doesn't quite roll off the tongue, but it's a very strong trademark. You know, you do a search for that, it's locked down. So in contrast, you got arbitrary marks. So if you think about, like, you know, Amazon, right? The mark Amazon, that's arbitrary for, like, online sales, but it is not arbitrary if you're, like, a travel company where you're going to the Amazon. So sunglasses at night, you know, what does sunglasses at night have to do with cider? You know, the connection's not very clear. It kind of, it gives the consumer a lot of potential for imagination, and that's what makes something a stronger trademark. And so there's that balance between with a fanciful mark like Exxon, you know, when Exxon started, it's like, what the heck's Exxon? You know, what's Kodak? So the consumer doesn't know what those fanciful trademarks are. So it's kind of this balancing act. You want to be distinctive enough that, you know, the consumer will recognize you and you can get trademark protection. But if you know, if you get too strange out there, then people might have trouble saying your name. You might run into issues. Another example of, you know, kind of going down the continuum towards weaker trademarks would be ginger grass. And so, again, that's kind of mashing up. We've got some flavors of ginger. We've got some flavors of lemongrass. It communicates something to the consumer, but it may not be as strong a trademark. On the weak end of the spectrum, you got you have, like, the unfiltered craft cider. You have Oregon Cider Company. Those are some weaker trademarks. These are, like, maybe three of the most common factual scenarios that I see. And, you know, the first one, it's what I call didn't look before you leapt. So you have a cidery, and they didn't do any kind of trademark search at all. They just weren't thinking about it. They're busy worried about fruit and tanks and, you know, space and all this stuff, and they didn't worry about trademarks. And so now they're in a situation where, you know, you have another alcoholic beverage company that has prior rights. So now you have a problem on your hands. And, you know, when there's a problem, there's a solution, but, you know, it might involve a rebrand. And that, you know, that involves, like, you know, re-educating your consumers. You know, you might have sunk costs and cans and all kinds of stuff, right? There's also that option of you take a license from somebody else, but that's, I typically don't like taking licenses from somebody else because let's say you've been calling your cider the name, right? And then somebody else has a registration and you're licensing that name from them. You're basically renting their name, all that goodwill. And what goodwill means is just sort of like the good feeling that a consumer gets from your brand, which can also be economically expressed as how likely are they going to buy from you again. All that goodwill goes to the company that you are licensing your mark from. You know, there's also options about, you know, money changing hands. Maybe you buy the mark, or, you know, maybe there's some kind of business, you know, collaboration. You know, sometimes, you know, you've seen stuff with like breweries where it's like collaboration, not litigation, and they have some kind of fun promotional event and they decide to live together. So the next common situation, so maybe you have like a cidery and they were the first ones to sell in the marketplace, you know, but they didn't register their trademarks. They didn't put up their wall. And so another beverage company comes along, and even though they've got junior rights, they register their trademark. And so now you have a situation where you have less trademark rights than you could have. And again, you have to pay an attorney to kind of figure this stuff out. You know, another third situation, I kind of think of this as like the low wall. You know, you've got like this fort and you've got this nice stone wall, but it's only like 2 feet tall and people can just step over it, right? And so that's when you have what is what's called a weak trademark. And again, that's not, you know, even though it says weak, it's not so much a judgment call, because some of the most famous brands that are out there in the marketplace are weak marks. But from a legal perspective, those are harder to defend. And, you know, they can be really difficult to register. And if you're using something with geography or describing a common feature of ciders, well, then there's going to be other people. There's going to be the Oakland Brewery that wants to launch. You know, there's going to be another company that's really into, like, you know, Brett Ciders and wants to have their own, you know, like, maybe they call it Barn Door or something, right? But, you know, there's those issues. You know, there's often this idea, especially in the wine space, right? People want to have, like, the family winery, and they want to have their family name. And it seems like a decade ago, it was a little easier to get your family name registered as a trademark. But technically, under the law, with federal trademarks, you can't register like a surname, a last name, because you want to give other people the ability to use that name. So if I want to have Regan Cidery, my name's Kevin Regan, you know, that's difficult to defend. And the trademark office will say, hey, sorry, that's primarily a surname. And so there's things you can do, but they're not easy. In contrast, if I said, hey, I'm Kevin Regan Cidery, that's like identifying me as an individual person, you can do that. Unfortunately, Kevin Regan's kind of a common name, so that kind of has some problems. But the upshot is like getting your last name, that's a little hard to do. It might be a little easier if you have a last name that means something else. You know, like if your name is Rivers, you know, you can maybe do some play on words where, you know, your logo has Rivers on it, and that would be a way to kind of sneak it in. You know, again, geography. And I understand why a lot of people, you know, want to do it. You want to be local, you want to be a part of the community, but, you know, that's something to watch out for. And there's often ways you can have like levels of intellectual property. It's not like you have to have one trademark. You can have a trademark in your, you know, the name of your company. You can have a trademark in the name of the individual cider. You can have a logo on the can. You can do these things in layers. Again, try to stay away from descriptive marks. So some of the simple takeaways from this is, you know, the way I like to say it is like, don't fall in love until you talk to a trademark attorney. So you got this brand idea, and it's like once you really start to like latch on to that idea, that's that dangerous place, because you start making these decisions that maybe, you know, don't have all the facts. So a lot of times with newer companies starting up, I'll say, hey, you know, give me a list of 5 ideas, and we'll look, is like one of these the path of least resistance, the easiest way to get up the mountain? And then I even get to a point sometimes where they keep giving me these names and it's not working. And so I'll sometimes, you know, teach my clients, here's how to do the basic searching yourself. But, you know, you still, even after you do that stuff, you know, do all that Google searching, all that, you know, you want to go and figure out like, well, what are, you know, what are the rights here? And one of the things that's weird is like, if you have different spellings for the same word, they'll still be lumped together. So there's some tricks to like, well, let's try spelling it different ways to make sure that there's not another mark that sounds similar. Because the test is like, does the trademark look too much like another mark? Does it sound too much like another mark? Or does it mean the same thing? You know, so something else, as I mentioned, filing an intent to use trademark application, filing those early and often That's like the best way to really kind of figure out where you stand in advance. I mean, just to give kind of a rough, you know, it all kind of depends on the facts. But like for me, a lot of like newer companies I'm working with, you know, I'll charge them like a flat rate for, you know, maybe somewhere between $1,000 to $15 to file an intent to use application. That includes, there's a government fee if you're filing. But, you know, basically, if you apply for something that's got a pretty good shot, like that might be your main cost to get your trademark registered, you know. And so if you can do something like that, that's a way to kind of, you know, put a little investment in on the front end to get that certainty. And again, there is no such thing as certainty, unfortunately. But if you have like a good, you know, good hand of cards to start with, and you can control that by filing an intent to use application, it gives you more options. So one of the parts that's not fun about this area is this what's called policing your trademarks. Again, if you don't enforce your trademarks, somebody else can get rights to them, and it can kind of knock out your trademark rights. So that's why it's good to, like, even if you do everything right, you know, you filed your intent to use application, you have a strong trademark, you know, there might be some brewery in the other side of the country that just doesn't know what they're doing, and you got to figure out, like, hey, how are we going to approach this? Can we have kind of a friendly solution where they're going to add another word to their trademark? You know, we're going to give them a little time to sell off their inventory. You know, every now and then you have a situation where like a big bad company will like, you know, not care about a smaller company's rights and kind of try to steamroll them. And those are the difficult situations, but that's where you hear about these big, you know, kind of jury awards and stuff. So, but again, a lot of companies, they'll do a trademark search, and if they see you registered, they'll move on to something else unless there's a really compelling brand need. Again, as I talked about, you know, it's like you want to have multiple layers of IP. And, you know, that can include trademarks, which we've been focusing on. But, you know, if you have some real unique ways to, like, how you're distributing your product, you know, if you're having, you know, really cool content, you know, these are things you might want to protect. So once you get that federal trademark, you'll want to mark that. You know, you want to put the R in a circle. And if you don't do that, it can affect your ability to get damages.
A question came up from the audience on images versus words that one would use for a brand and how images might be difficult to secure or to know if it is unique.
The legal test is taking the trademark as a whole. You know, the fox standing there on front of the barrel, is that different enough from a fox running? You know, there's searches you can do. Like if you're searching for trees in the space of cider, like that's going to be difficult. So as an attorney, if I do a search, I'm going to get a lot of hits, right? I'm making up examples because I think there is like a penguin in the hard alcohol space. But in contrast, if my picture is a penguin, that's like a less common thing in the alcohol beverage space. So a lot of it is, you know, figuring out like what kind of picture. I mean, if it's a walrus, you're talking even rarer. So I can like have more confidence of saying, well, look, there's only four other walruses. Your walrus is looking pretty different. But if it's an apple tree, that's a tricky thing. And I mean, even if you take Angry Orchard, right? They didn't just have like an outline of an apple tree. You know, they have this like kind of unhappy looking apple with the sort of like half-eaten apples hanging off it. And so those are some of the elements where maybe if you have an apple tree, they're not going to go after you. But if you have like an apple tree that's got two half-eaten apples on it, you're probably going to get some kind of letter.
Next question came up about how to manage cease and desist letters.
You know, really with cease and desist letters, you really need to talk to an attorney. You know, don't send one on your own because, you know, there's that factual situation, right? You know, like that big company, they sent a cease and desist and then they ended up like having to pay my client a bunch of money to acquire that trademark. You know, there might have been other ways that they can handle it. But like, you know, if somebody's kind of litigious and you send them a cease and desist letter, they'll say, oh, well, we actually have priority. We need to shut this down. And then they might sue you for declaratory relief saying, hey, we actually have prior trademark rights. So, you know, the first pointer would be like, don't just send a cease and desist letter without like sort of coming up with a strategy, because there's some real risks. When you threaten somebody, you know, I've got actually right now two cannabis companies that are duking it out in state court. You know, they're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it's like, you know, one of them sent a cease and desist and got this litigation rolling. And, you know, there's a lot of consequences that come from that. You kind of want to pick your battles, right? It's like a lot of law kind of comes down to these sort of business decisions. You know, if it's like an obscure, like, you know, somebody's making absinthe, right? And it's real small and it's real boutique. You know, there might be some ways you can kind of creatively resolve that. And there's like a continuum of cease and desist letters. There's the friendly cease and desist letters, you know, like as an example of something that's really crazy. So like Duke, you know, the school with the basketball team, anything that's got the letter D in it, like let's just say you had the letter D in your cider somewhat prominently, you're going to get this letter from Duke, and it's called the Notice of Trademark. Hey, we have this trademark. Be aware, if you use these color blues, if you use these fonts, we think there's an issue. So, you know, pick your battles. That's the second piece. And then the third is, I'd say, like, you know, don't just shove these things under the rug. Like, you know, I often get a call from a client, and on the one hand, you know, they're panicking because, like, you know, they walked into a, you know, they walked into Whole Foods, right? And then they see, you know, they're a cidery, and they see a gin with the same name. And so on the one hand, you know, there's people who they immediately take action, they call me up. But then others, they just kind of shove it under the rug and they kind of forget about it for a few years, kind of out of sight, out of mind. And that's when things get more expensive, because if that, let's say that spirit company's got money and they start, you know, if you start getting more recognition in the marketplace, it gives you some clay to work with, you know, to say, hey, well, we're actually we have more, you know, use rights because people recognize us more. Sometimes at the patent and trademark office or in a court, there's something called a survey where they will actually, you know, have a branding company that'll come up with a scientific survey and say, hey, consumers, when they see this, they think of us. And that gives, you know, some clay to work with.
Next question is the use of PMO on a product in the U.S., if that is permissible, in that it is a controlled appellation in France. This is what Kevin has to say about that.
The textbook examples would be champagne, right? And, you know, it's kind of funny because just for a little perspective, it's easy to lose sight, you know, here in the U.S., you know, you got to deal with TTB. You know, you have to deal with like the Washington Liquor and Cannabis Board or ABC here in California. It seems like there's a lot of bureaucratic layers. But man, when you compare that to France, I mean, from the wine perspective, they tell you when you can pick those grapes. I mean, it is really regulated. And so now there's this trend where you have, you know, these kind of international standards of identity, and, you know, countries will take steps like Spain, you know, France, you know, whether it's cheese or beer or wine, trying to get these protections. So the easy example is champagne, right? And Korbel, they make sparkling wine in California. They've been around a long time, but you might notice they call it California champagne, and they're kind of grandfathered in. Other people can't do that now. You know, they can say it's California sparkling wine, but not champagne. So I think, you know, the example you gave, you know, you'd want to maybe call your trademark something that's not what might be called the standard of identity later on, where, well, only, you know, like Sidra from Spain, you know, meeting these characteristics, you know, you maybe don't want to use the word Sidra. It just depends, you know. Somewhere else in terms of where the law might be going, you know, with the wine space, you have all this regulations about, okay, if you say you're Cabernet Sauvignon, you got to have X percentage of Cabernet Sauvignon. And we don't really have those regulations yet in the cider industry, but they might come because, you know, if you're going to say you're a certain varietal of apple, at some point, I think more regulation is kind of coming down the road.
Oh, Kevin, we don't like to leave it like that, but I think we will. More regulation is coming down the line. So I hope that this piece on trademark will help you think ahead if you're getting into building a cidery, or even if you are already in business. I could speak from my own vantage. I had my other business for many, many years before I started working at an international level. And when that happened, I knew I really had to secure things. So I did get a trademark for my brand and logo. And I also, over the course of time, have, as a content creator, have a lot of intellectual property and have secured copyrights because of that. So I could speak from experience that it is really worth it and has saved me more than once having those major hurdles crossed. I also know locally here, there is a current, he was talking about Duke University, there is a local brewery here called Iron Duke Brewery. And wouldn't you know it, Duke University is making them change their name. Now they've been in business for, I don't know, 5 years. And the amount of money now that's going to cost them to deal with that is just such a drag, you know, and then having to restart their engine. maybe their saving grace in some ways is COVID, because, you know, they kind of get to come out of COVID with a new look and a new face. But who wants to go through that? I mean, once you fall in love with your brand, you don't really want to like be changing it back again. So it's all about due diligence and looking beyond just the cider community. If you have a brand name, you might want to check the brewing industry. In fact, I could tell you for a fact, I'm seeing that happen now in the cider industry and not any due diligence taking place. And I'm worried about it. Look, Ciderville, I want you to be successful. I don't want you to have to deal with some of the hassles that I have had or others over time. So be well and take care, and don't take it for granted that it's yours until is signed on the dotted line. Next week on part 3 of Building a Cidery, we're going to be featuring a maker who will be sharing with us the experience of going through the process of building up a cidery, what worked, what didn't work, what one might do differently. I'm really excited because I have a number of makers lined up to talk about this, and I think it will help you and also shed a little light on what's happening in their special spot in Ciderville. I tell you who that is, but I don't want to let the cat out of the hat yet, or the rabbit out of the hat, or whatever have you. We'll wait until then. And maybe while you're waiting, and you have a little bit of time there, maybe you could go to the Cider Chat Patreon page and sign up and become a patron if you haven't yet. Because this podcast really relies on the contribution of fine listeners just like you to help keep cider going up and keep the news circulating around the world of all the good cheer that we have. Just Google Patreon. It's spelled Patreon and Cider Chat. With that, I leave you here. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider. Ponds. We love orchards and having fun. There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh, yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider, we like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this. Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh, yeah.
We like cider.
Oh, yes, we do.
Like palms.
Oh, yes, we do.
We love orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum. Ba-da-da-dum.
We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh, yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh, yes, we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
It's just the truth.
Yeehaw!